on the 23rd of February in Moscow. I went to sleep in Moscow and I woke up in the morning in Tehran. It was a changed country. The Jewish leaders, among other religious leaders, were asked to support the war, and I refused to do so.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. The story of Jews in Russia is a dramatic one. At different points in history, they were discriminated against and even executed. When the collapse of the Soviet Union occurred, many could finally flee. And those who stayed behind hoped for a democratic and religiously tolerant Kremlin. But as you're about to hear, much of that changed when President Putin slowly tightened his grip on freedoms from fascism to totalitarianism. The chief rabbi of Moscow, Pinchas Goldschmidt, resisted state pressure to support Putin's war in Ukraine. But the rabbi was forced to flee and now talks to us about what kind of Russia he left behind and what happens to Russia's Jews now. Rabbi yes. Pinchas Goldschmidt was the chief rabbi in Moscow. He left Russia in March, and reports say that he did so because of state pressure to support the war in Ukraine. And he joins us now from Israel. Shalom, Rabbi.
Hi, shalom, Dana.
Can I ask you, in your own words, why did you leave Russia?
I said a few times already in the press that when I went to sleep on the 23rd of February in Moscow, I went to sleep in Moscow and I woke up in the morning in Tehran. It was a changed country with a changed political climate and a changed climate for the Jewish community. And as the war progressed, the Jewish leaders, among other religious leaders, were asked to support the war. And I refused to do so. And at that moment, I decided that I will not only not support the war, we will also support the refugees, the thousands and thousands of Jewish refugees who among the millions left Ukraine. And I left with my wife, Dara, to Eastern Europe to support the Jewish refugees in Eastern Europe. And came out openly against the war.
Huge decisions. Who asked you to support the war, or if you don't want to say who, kind of how did it happen and what did you tell them?
Obviously, it was the government. The government demanded from religious leaders to support the war, and we refused to do so.
And what did you tell them?
We said nothing.
Booked an airline ticket and got out of there, because to say something may have personally endangered
at that moment,
you.
I'm talking about the beginning of the war and the beginning of March. The community leaders realized that coming out against the war in Russia at that moment, like it is today, would be dangerous for the individuals as well as for the community. So it was decided just to keep silent, but it was a deafening silence.
It's important to talk about that community, right? Because under the Soviet Union, Jews could not leave. And then when perestroika happened and the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, millions of Jews left, and many of them went, you know, made aliyah and went to places like where you are now in Israel. Others went to the U.S. and elsewhere. But even as we speak, there are, what, 500,000 Jews still in Russia? And what is their situation?
When I arrived in Moscow in 1989, I think it was a little before you arrived in Moscow, still at the end of the Soviet times, I think there were over 1 million Jews who lived in Moscow. Today, I think there are different opinions, but the core community of Jews in Russia, I think, is under 200,000. And the extended community, I think, goes up to 600,000. And as you know, in Israel, they're discussing the changing of the law of return, which today allows third generations of descendants of Jews also to receive Israeli citizenship.
So what does it mean they're assessing it? And what can happen to those remaining 200,000 or so Jews that are still there?
So according to our assessment, since the war started, over 50,000 Jews or descendants of Jews moved to Israel. According to the official count, it's above 32,000, but the official numbers count only those who came to Israel and became Israelis. But we shouldn't forget the multitude, the thousands and tens of thousands of Jews in Russia who prior to that had already Israeli citizenship. So we believe the actual number is over 50,000. We know that tens of thousands left for the near abroad, meaning to Yerevan, Baku, Tbilisi, also to Istanbul. And we're also getting many, many regards from Dubai. Thousands of Jews left for Dubai. And according to the last numbers we're getting, about 80,000 Jews or people of Jewish descent are in the process of getting the papers in Russia in order to go on Aliyah to Israel. So we're talking about a very massive emigration, which has not happened since the early 90s, late 80s. And in real numbers, I think we talk about between 25 to 30% of the actual Jewish community packing their bags and leaving.
And Rabbi, it may seem like a simple question, but why do they have to leave? Why do they feel they need to go now?
I think that there are many reasons for it. Let me start, number one, with what I've started. The political climate has changed, and people are speaking about Russia as the new Soviet Union. And one of the main characteristics of the Soviet Union was the Iron Curtain, the lack of freedom of movement. Now, today you still have officially freedom of movement, but in practice, there are no flights to the West. In order to fly to somewhere, you have to fly either through Tel Aviv or Istanbul. It is nearly impossible for Russians to get visas anywhere. And with the latest draft, we expect, we fear that in the near future, might be as soon as January, that any male between 20 and 60 or 65 who is eligible to serve in the Russian army will be forbidden to leave the country. So that's number one, the descending Iron Curtain. Number two is
that's
the rising
a big number one, by the way. That's a big number one.
Right. Number two is the rising anti-Semitism. I just would like to point out that the closing of the Jewish agency by the Russian government and a member of the Security Council attacking Chabad, which is a major part of the Jewish community, as satanic cult. That's number two. Number three.
Who was that on the Security Council?
It was a secretary of the Security Council who wrote an article. And to some extent afterwards, the head of the Security Council was approached and said, yeah, well, we're going to have to work with this person and explain that what you wrote was wrong. You know, it was nothing terrible, but it was not an apology.
Well, it is not a minor slight to the Jewish community. A lot of people would see that in a totalitarian fascist state as a frightening thing to say about a sect of the Jewish community there.
Exactly. When we're talking about a country which is already went from an authoritarian regime to a semi-totalitarian regime, any sign from above has huge ramifications. I'll give you another example. A few months ago, Foreign Minister Lavrov mentioned that Adolf Hitler was of Jewish descent. I received a report that right afterwards, there were many attacks against the Jewish community on social media. So there's a direct correlation between actual anti-Semitism and the signs the government is giving to the people.
And anti-Semitism, as we all know, on social media, it begins on social media, but unfortunately, some of these end in violence on the street.
Yes, I think that the attack against the synagogue in Pittsburgh is the best example. That it was led by a person, and also the attack against it's not anti-Semitism, but Islamophobia against the mosque in Christchurch in New Zealand was also on video in real time on Facebook. So we're talking about ISIS executions. These are crimes which are propagated and induced by social media, which is a major reason for the existence and the growing anti-Semitism today.
And you said number three.
That's the second. Yeah, number three is the mounting repression against the opposition, against anyone who is voicing her or his voice against the war. Thousands are being arrested. And Jews are more aware of what is happening. They believe much less what is being told to them on national TV, on those propaganda channels. And therefore, I think Jews also remember, have a historical memory of the anti-Semitic culminations in Russian history. Let's talk about the beginning of the 20th century, the pogroms in southern Russia, in Kishinev, in Odessa, and when the Tsarist regime was about to fall, and then again at the end of the Stalin period, in the 1952, the doctor's plot. So there's a great fear that anti-Semitism is going to grow as the political situation is heading to showdown.
Will you retell me the story, just very briefly, if you don't mind, of Rabbi Medalia? Because I know that that is something that you talked about in an article that you wrote for the New York Times.
Yes, Rabbi Medalia was the major rabbinical figure in Soviet Russia after the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe left Russia in 1926. And he was a voice of protest, and he tried to keep the Jewish community running as well as it could under the increasing totalitarian regime of Stalin. And in he was arrested in 1937 and executed in 1938.
Executed.
When I arrived in the Kol synagogue, when I arrived in 1989 to the Kol synagogue, there was a memorial plaque for all the previous serving rabbis and the rabbis who served after him, but there was nothing in his memory. He was an enemy of the state. And I donated to the synagogue a parochet for the Holy Ark, where his name and the year of his execution was mentioned.
You don't mind me reading you one thing that you wrote, because I found your editorial quite moving, and that's why I reached out to you. For years, we hoped that democratic institutions in Russia would take root. We hoped the Jewish communities could keep their distance from President Vladimir Putin's increasing authoritarianism. His regime's social contract, after all, was that the population would not be politically active while allowing the authorities to conduct their affairs. Our hopes were crushed. Can you just expand on that in terms of tell me, you know, how your hope was crushed? Obviously, you're referring to the fact that they wanted you to endorse what they were doing on the ground in Ukraine.
Exactly. I think here we touch on the great difference between an authoritarian and totalitarian regime. The authoritarian regime is exactly what it was. It tries to depoliticize its population, telling them not to get involved in governmental affairs, while everyone's lives can be conducted individually without the interference of the state. While in a totalitarian regime, it's just the opposite. Every decision is dependent on the government, and the government expects you to be totally engaged in supporting governmental affairs. And if you're not going to do that, there are going to be repercussions. And that's exactly the change which happened overnight from the 23rd to the 24th of February.
And you say that the hardest task of religious leadership is to take moral stances in difficult times, no matter what the cost, and you are paying a personal cost to take that stance.
Definitely, religious leaders have to weigh at all times the cost, not only for them personally, but also to the community and the existence of the community and the future of the community. And this was the reason why in earlier times, that's something I was asked, why didn't I speak up earlier? Why didn't I speak up in the year 2014, et cetera? Because at that time, the cost and benefit for, not speaking personally, but for the community was different than today. I came to the realization that it's not only impossible for me to continue to thrive in such a country, but it will be very difficult, nearly impossible for the community to do so. And therefore, I joined the call of Natan Sharansky to my community and to Jews of Russia that the time has come to leave.
You're in Jerusalem, and you know as you walk down those steps towards the Western Wall, there's a synagogue on the way down the steps, and there are six candles there that burn for 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust, that terrible reminder of the human toll from what took place in the Holocaust. Are there parallels now with the rise of far-right regimes, not only in Russia, but fascism, totalitarianism, it seems to be spreading in many different places that you wouldn't expect that they are. And as a religious leader, and how do you kind of process that? What are the danger signs right now that we're seeing, and how do you reflect on what's taking place?
The fact that Europe is again at war, that you have millions of refugees, is definitely a parallel to World War II 8 years ago, and seeing all those refugees looking for shelter. But when I went to a train station on the border of Hungary and Ukraine at the beginning of the war, and I saw at the train station the different stands of the Catholic Church, of the Protestant Church, and of the Jewish community waiting for refugees to come and to feed them and to house them and to shelter them. This is the big difference. I would like to say that in these difficult times, I think that the silver lining is the way that European countries opened their borders to help refugees. And I would like especially express my admiration for the Jewish communities of Europe, which have received and integrated a great number of refugees. Talking, for example, just giving you an example of the community of Basel in Switzerland, which has 800 members, they receive more than 100 refugees from Ukraine. In Vienna, it was 10 times this number. So what we are seeing is really a beautiful way in which Europe has sheltered those refugees, who 70% of them are women and children. Now, the danger which we have all over the world today is that politics are becoming more and more extreme. We're talking about populism and identity politics. And we're seeing that in many European countries, the far right is gaining power, joining governments, and this influences the political climate, not only in these far right parties, but even in establishment parties.
And how do you resist that danger? I mean, how do we? It just seems we're in a cycle to repeat history, perhaps not precisely repeat, but the same nurturing of hatred, which you must fear, and you must philosophically have an idea on how we fight that.
We have on one hand, we have the tool of education, of educating our children, the next generation. You see, for them, the Holocaust is not anymore part of their lives. Holocaust survivors, the last ones are about to leave us, and the perpetrators, the last ones are perpetrators about to leave this world. So it's really like history, like World War I, like Napoleonic War. So what we need is to educate those children, bring them to concentration camps, visit those sites and explain what happens when racism, when totalitarianism takes over a country and divides and destroys our countries in Europe. Number two, part of this whole process of our political culture becoming so more violent and extreme is the social media. And here, the European Union, but it's not enough, and countries have implemented regulations on the big tech companies and took them to task that they gave their platforms for all those voices which are trying to destroy our society.
So important. Rabbi Goldschmidt, thank you so much for taking the time to talk. It's been hard to get hold of you, but it was worth the wait. And I appreciate so much, your message, and wish you well, sir. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you very much for having me, Dana.
And that's our backstory on Russian Jews. Rabbi Goldschmidt wrote in an editorial on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement for Jews worldwide, "Let us remember that it is the role of faith to counter evil and to fight for basic human rights of liberty and life." Jews, by the way, blow a ram's horn or shofar at the end of Yom Kippur, and the rabbi noted, "Sometimes the costs of blowing that shofar are high. Sometimes one is dragged off by the secret police, and sometimes one finds oneself in exile." I think we all have to stand up to tyranny, and Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine is one of those moments in our history. I'm Dana Lewis. Thanks for listening to Backstory, and I'll talk to you again soon.